Entry we all listened to last night as they made a public spectacle of selling themselves to KSF.
Good luck to them, Dad said. Not that they'll have much luck in the long run.
What do you mean? Corey demanded. I think the whole idea is wonderful. It's what we need. Now, if only some big company would want to do the same thing with Robledo.
No, Dad said. Thank God, no.
You don't know. Why shouldn't they?
Robledo's too big, too poor, too black, and too Hispanic to be of interest to anyone, and it has no coastline. What it does have is street poor, body dumps, and a memory of once being well off. Of shade trees, big houses, hills, and canyons. Most of those things are still here, but no company will want us. At the end of the program, it was announced that KSF was looking for registered nurses, credentialed teachers, and a few other skilled professionals who would be willing to move to Olivar and work for room and board. The offer wasn't put that way, of course, but that's what it meant. Yet Corey recorded the phone number and called it at once. She and Dad are both teachers, both PhDs. She was desperate to get in ahead of the crowd. Dad just shrugged and let her call. Room and board. The offered salaries were so low that if Dad and Corey both worked, they wouldn't earn as much as Dad is earning now with the college. And out of it, they'd have to pay rent as well as the usual expenses. In fact, when you add everything up, it's clear that with the six of us, they couldn't earn enough to meet expenses. It might work if I could find a job of some kind, but in Olivar, they don't need me. They've got hundreds of me at least, maybe thousands. Every surviving community is full of unemployed, half-educated kids or unemployed, uneducated kids. Anyone KSF hired would have a hard time living on the salary offered. In not very much time, I think the new hires would be in debt to the company. That's an old company town trick. Get people into debt, hang on to them, and work them harder. Debt slavery. That might work in Christopher Donner's America. Labor laws, state and federal, are not what they once were.
We could try, Corey insisted to Dad. We could be safe in Olivar. The kids could go to a real school and later get jobs with the company. After all, where can they go from here except outside?
Dad shook his head. Don't hope for it, Corey. There's nothing safe about slavery.
Marcus and I were still up, listening. The two younger boys had been sent to bed, but we four were still clustered around the radio. Now Marcus spoke up.
Olivar doesn't sound like slavery, he said. Those rich people would never let themselves be slaves.
Dad gave him a sad smile.
Not now, he said. Not at first.
He shook his head. Kajimoto Stam Frampton. Japanese, German, Canadian. When I was young, people said it would come to this. Well, why shouldn't other countries buy what's left of us if we put it up for sale? I wonder how many of the people in Olivar have any idea what they're doing.
I don't think many do, I said. I don't think they dare let themselves know.
He looked at me, and I looked back. I'm still learning how dogged people can be in denial, even when their freedom or their lives are at stake. He's lived with it longer. I wonder how.
Marcus said, Lauren, you ought to want to go to some place like Olivar more than anyone. You share pain every time you see someone get hurt. There'd be a lot less pain in Olivar.
And there would be all those guards, I said. I've noticed that people who have a little bit of power tend to use it. All those guards KSF is bringing in, they won't be allowed to bother the rich people, at least at first. But new, bare-bones, work-for-room-and-board employees, I'll bet they'll be fair game.
There's no reason to believe the company would allow that kind of thing, Corey said. Why do you always expect the worst of everyone?
When it comes to strangers with guns, I told her, I think suspicion is more likely to keep you alive than trust.
She made a sharp, wordless sound of disgust.
You know nothing about the world. You think you have all the answers, but you know nothing.
I didn't argue. There wasn't much point in my arguing with her.
I doubt that Olivar is looking for families of blacks and Hispanics anyway, Dad said. The Balters, or the Garfields, or even some of the Dunns might get in, but I don't think we would, even if I were trusting enough to put my family into KSF's hands. They wouldn't have us.
We could try it, Corey insisted. We should. We wouldn't be any worse off than we are now if they turn us down. And if we got in and we didn't like it, we could come back here. We could rent the house to one of the big families here, charge them just a little, then
come back here jobless and penniless, Dad said.
No, I mean it. This business sounds half antebellum revival and half science fiction. I don't trust it. Freedom is dangerous, Corey, but it's precious, too. You can't just throw it away or let it slip away. You can't sell it for bread and pottage.
Corey stared at him, just stared. He refused to look away. Corey got up and went to their bedroom. I saw her there a few minutes later, sitting on the bed, cradling the urn of Keith's ashes and crying.
Saturday, October 24th, 2026. Marcus tells me the Garfields are trying to get into Olivar. He's been spending a lot of time with Robin Balter, and she told him. She hates the idea because she likes her cousin Joanne a lot better than she does her two sisters. She's afraid that if Joanne goes away to Olivar, she'll never see her again. I suspect she's right. I can't imagine this place without the Garfields. Joanne, Jay, Phyllida. We've lost individuals before, of course, but we've never lost a whole family. I mean, they'll be alive, but they'll be gone. I hope they're refused. I know it's selfish, but I don't care. Not that it makes any difference what I hope. Oh, hell. I hope they get whatever will be best for their survival. I hope they'll be all right.
At 13, my brother Marcus has become the only person in the family whom I could call beautiful. Girls his age stare at him when they think he's not looking. They giggle a lot around him and chase him like crazy, but he sticks to Robin. She's not pretty at all skin and bones and brains, but she's funny and sensible. In a year or two, she'll start to fill out, and my brother will get beauty along with all those brains. Then, if the two of them are still together, their lives will get a lot more interesting. I've changed my mind. I used to wait for the explosion, the big crash, the sudden chaos that would destroy the neighborhood. Instead, things are unraveling, disintegrating bit by bit. Susan Talcott Bruce and her husband have applied to Olivar. Other people are talking about applying, thinking about it. There's a small college in Olivar. There are lethal security devices to keep thugs in the street poor out. There are more jobs opening up. Maybe Olivar is the future. One face of it. Cities controlled by big companies are old hat in science fiction. My grandmother left a whole bookcase of old science fiction novels. The company city subgenre always seemed to star a hero who outsmarted, overthrew, or escaped the company. I've never seen one where the hero fought like hell to get taken in and underpaid by the company. In real life, that's the way it will be. That's the way it is. And what should I be doing? What can I do?
In less than a year, I'll be 18. An adult. An adult with no prospects, except life in our disintegrating neighborhood. Or Earthseed. To begin Earthseed, I'll have to go outside. I've known that for a long time, but the idea scares me just as much as it always has. Next year, when I'm 18, I'll go. That means now I have to begin to plan how I'll handle it. Saturday, October 31st, 2026. I'm going to go north. My grandparents once traveled a lot by car. They left us old road maps of just about every county in the state, plus several of other parts of the country. The newest of them is 40 years old, but that doesn't matter. The roads will still be there. They'll just be in worse shape than they were back when my grandparents drove a gas-fueled car over them. I've put maps of the California counties north of us, and the few I could find of Washington and Oregon counties, into my pack. I wonder if there are people outside who will pay me to teach them reading and writing, basic stuff, or if people will pay me to read or write for them. Keith started me thinking about that. I might even be able to teach some Earthseed verses along with the reading and writing. Given any chance at all, teaching is what I would choose to do. Even if I have to take other kinds of work to get enough to eat, I can teach. If I do it well, I will draw people to me, to Earthseed. All successful life is adaptable, opportunistic, tenacious, interconnected, and fecund. Understand this, use it. Shape God. I wrote that verse a few months ago. It's true, like all the verses. It seems more true than ever now, more useful to me when I'm afraid. I've finally got a title for my book of Earthseed verses. Earthseed, the Book of the Living. There are the Tibetan and the Egyptian books of the dead. Dad has copies of them. I've never heard of anything called a Book of the Living, but I wouldn't be surprised to discover that there is something. I don't care. I'm trying to speak, to write the truth. I'm trying to be clear. I'm not interested in being fancy or even original. Clarity and truth will be plenty if I can only achieve them. If it happens that there are other people outside somewhere preaching my truth, I'll join them. Otherwise, I'll adapt where I must, take what opportunities I can find or make, hang on, gather students, and teach. Chapter 12. We are Earthseed, the life that perceives itself changing. Earthseed, the Books of the Living. Saturday, November 14th, 2026. The Garfields have been accepted at Olivar. They'll be moving next month. That's soon. I've known them all my life, and they'll be gone. Joanne and I have had our differences, but we grew up together. I thought somehow that when I left, she would still be here. Everyone would still be here, frozen in time just as I left them. But no, that's fantasy. God is change. Do you want to go? I asked her this morning. We had gotten together to pick a few early lemons and navel oranges and some persimmons, almost ripe and brilliant orange. We picked at my house and then at hers, enjoying the work. The weather was cool. It was good to be outside. I have to go, she said. What else is there for me, for anyone? It's all going to hell here. You know it is. I stared at her. I guess discussing such things is all right now that she has a way out. So, You move into another fortress, I said. It's a better fortress. It won't have people coming over the walls, killing old ladies. Your mother says all you'll have is an apartment. No yard, no garden. You'll have less money, but you'll have to use more of it to buy food. We'll manage. There was a brittle quality to her voice. I put down the old rake I was using as a fruit picker. It worked fine on the lemons and oranges. Scared? I asked. She put down her own real fruit picker with its awkward extension handle and small fruit-catching basket. It was best for persimmons. She hugged herself. I've lived here, lived with trees and gardens all my life. I don't know how it will be to be shut up in an apartment. It does scare me, but we'll manage. We'll have to. You can come back here if things aren't what you hope. Your grandparents and your aunt's family will still be here. Harry will still be here, she whispered, looking toward her house. I would have to stop thinking of it as the Garfield house. Harry and Joanne were at least as close as Curtis and I. I hadn't thought about her leaving him, what that must be like. I like Harry Balter. I remember being surprised when he and Joanne first started going together. They'd lived in the same house all their lives. I had thought of Harry almost as her brother, but they were only first cousins, and against the odds they had managed to fall in love, or I thought they had. They hadn't gone with anyone else for years. Everyone assumed they would get around to marrying when they were a little older. Marry him and take him with you, I said. He won't go, she said in that same whisper. We've talked and talked about it. He wants me to stay here with him, get married soon and go north, just go, with no prospects, nothing. It's crazy. Why won't he go to Olivar? He thinks the way your father thinks. He thinks Olivar is a trap. He's read about 19th and early 20th century company towns. And he says no matter how great Olivar looks, all we'll get from it in the end is debt and loss of freedom. I knew Harry had sense. Joe, I said, you'll be of age next year. You could stay here with the Balters until then and marry. Or you could talk your father into letting you marry now. And then what? Go join the street poor? Stay and stuff more babies into that crowded house? Harry doesn't have a job, and there's no real chance of his getting one that pays money. Are we supposed to live on what Harry's parents earn? What kind of future is that? None. None at all. Sensible, conservative, and sensible, and mature, and wrong. Very much in character for Joanne. Or maybe I was the one who was wrong. Maybe the security Joanne will find in Olivar is the only kind of security to be had for anyone who isn't rich. To me, though, security in Olivar isn't much more attractive than the security Keith has finally found in his urn. I picked a few more lemons and some oranges and wondered what she would do if she knew I was planning to leave next year. Would she run to her mother again, frightened for me, and eager to have someone protect me from myself? She might. She wants a future she can understand and depend on, a future that looks a lot like her parents' present. I don't think that's possible. Things are changing too much, too fast. Who can fight God? We put baskets of fruit inside my back door on the porch, then headed for her house. What will you do? She asked me as we walked. Are you just going to stay here? I mean, are you going to stay and marry Curtis? I shrugged and lied. I don't know. If I marry anyone, it will be Curtis. But I don't know about marrying. I don't want to have children here any more than you do. I know we'll be staying here for a while longer, though. Dad won't let Corey even apply to Olivar. I'm glad of that, because I don't want to go there. But there'll be other Olivars. Who knows what I might wind up doing? The last part didn't feel like a lie.
You think there'll be more privatized cities? She asked.
Bound to be if Olivar succeeds. This country is going to be parceled out as a source of cheap labor and cheap land. When people like those in Olivar beg to sell themselves, our surviving cities are bound to wind up the economic colonies of whoever can afford to buy them.
Oh, God, there you go again. You've always got a disaster up your sleeve.
I see what's out there. You see it, too. You just deny it. Remember when you thought starving hordes were going to come crawling over our walls and we would have to run away to the mountains and eat grass?
Did I remember? I turned to face her, first angry, furious, then to my own surprise, sad.
I'll miss you, I said. She must have read my feelings.
I'm sorry, she whispered.
We hugged each other. I didn't ask her what she was sorry for, and she didn't say any more. Tuesday, November 17th, 2026. Dad didn't come home today. He was due this morning. I don't know what that means. I don't know what to think. I'm scared to death. Corey called the college, his friends, fellow ministers, co-workers, the cops, the hospitals. Nothing. He isn't under arrest or sick or injured or dead, at least not as far as anyone knows. None of his friends or colleagues has seen him since he left work early this morning. His bike was working all right. He was all right. He had ridden off toward home with three co-workers, who lived in other neighborhoods in our area. Each of them said the same thing, that they had left him, as usual, at River Street, where it intersects Durant Road. That's only 5 blocks from here. We're at the tip end of Durant Road. So where is he? Today, a group of us, all armed, rode bicycles from home to River Street and down River Street to the college, 5 miles in all. We checked side streets, alleys, vacant buildings, every place we could think of. I went. I took Marcus with me because if I hadn't, he would have gone out alone. I had the Smith & Wesson. Marcus had only his knife. He's quick and agile with it, and strong for his age, but he's never used it on anything alive. If anything had happened to him, I don't think I would have dared to go home. Corey is already out of her mind with worry. All this on top of losing Keith? I don't know. Everyone helped. Jay Garfield will be leaving soon, but that didn't stop him from leading the search. He's a good man. He did everything he could think of to find Dad. Tomorrow, we're going into the hills and canyons. We have to. No one wants to, but what else can we do? Wednesday, November 18th, 2026. I've never seen more squalor, more human remains, more feral dogs than I saw today. I have to write. I have to dump this onto paper. I can't keep it inside of me. Seeing the dead has never bothered me before, but this... We were looking for Dad's body, of course, though no one said so. I couldn't deny that reality or avoid thinking about it. Corey checked with the police again, with the hospitals, with everyone we could think of who knew Dad. Nothing. So, we had to go to the hills. When we go for target practice, we don't look around, except to ensure safety. We don't look for what we'd rather not find. Today, in groups of 3 or 4, we combed through the area nearest to the top of River Street. I kept Marcus with me, which was not easy. What is it in young boys that makes them want to wander off alone and get killed? They get two chin hairs and they're trying to prove they're men.
You watch my back, and I'll watch yours, I said. I'm not going to let you get hurt. Don't you let me down.
He gave me the kind of near smile that said he knew exactly what I was trying to do and that he was going to do as he pleased. I got mad and grabbed him by the shoulders. Damn it, Marcus! How many sisters have you got? How many fathers have you got?
I never used even mild profanity with him unless things were very serious. Now it got his attention.
Don't worry, he muttered. I'll help.
Then we found the arm. Marcus was the one who spotted it, something dark lying just off the trail we were following. It was hung up in the low branches of a scrub oak. The arm was fresh and whole, a hand, a lower and an upper arm. A black man's arm, just the color of my father's, where color could be seen. It was slashed and cut all over, yet still powerful-looking, long-boned, long-fingered, yet muscular and massive. Familiar? Smooth white bone stuck out at the shoulder end. The arm had been cut off with a sharp knife. The bone wasn't broken, and yes, it could have been his. Marcus threw up when he saw it. I made myself examine it, search it for something familiar, for certainty. Jay Garfield tried to stop me, and I shoved him away and told him to go to hell. I'm sorry for that, and I told him so later, but I had to know. And yet I still don't know. The arm was too slashed and covered in dried blood. I couldn't tell. Jay Garfield took fingerprints in his pocket notebook, but we left the arm itself. How could we take that back to Corey? And we kept searching. What else could we do? George Sue found a rattlesnake. It didn't bite anyone, and we didn't kill it. I don't think anyone was in a mood to kill things. We saw dogs, but they kept away from us. I even saw a cat watching us from under a bush. Cats either run like hell or crouch and freeze. They're interesting to watch somehow. Or at any other time, they'd be interesting. Then someone began to scream. I've never heard screams like that before. On and on. A man screaming, begging, praying. No, no more. Oh, God, no more. Please. Jesus. Jesus, please. Then there were wordless, grating cries and a high, horrible mewling. It was a man's voice. Not like my father's, but not that different from his. We couldn't locate the source. The echoes bounced around the canyon, confusing us, sending us first in one direction, then in another. The canyon was full of loose rock and spiny, vicious plants that kept us on the pathways where there were pathways. The screaming stopped, then began again as a kind of horrible, bubbling noise. I had let myself fall back to the end of the line of us by then. I wasn't in trouble. Sound doesn't trigger my sharing. I have to see another person in pain before I do any sharing. And this was one I'd do anything to avoid seeing. Marcus dropped back beside me and whispered, "You okay?" "Yeah," I said. "I just don't want to know anything about what's happening to that man." "Keith," he said. "I know," I agreed. We walked our bikes behind the others, watching the back trail. Kayla Talcott dropped back to see if we were all right. She hadn't wanted us to come, but since we had come, she had come. She had kept an eye on us. She's like that.
"It doesn't sound like your daddy," she said. "Doesn't sound like him at all."
Kayla is from Texas, like my biological mother. Sometimes she sounded as though she'd never left, and sometimes she sounded as though she'd never been near any part of the South. She seemed to be able to turn the accent on and off.
She tended to turn it on for comforting people and for threatening to kill them. Sometimes, when I'm with Curtis, I see her in his face and wonder what kind of relative, what kind of mother-in-law she would make. Today, I think both Marcus and I were glad she was there. We needed to be close to someone with her kind of mothering strength. The horrible noise ended. Maybe the poor man was dead and out of his misery. I hope so. We never found him. We found human bones and animal bones. We found the rotting corpses of 5 people scattered among the boulders. We found the cold remains of a fire with the human femur and 2 human skulls lying among the ashes. At last, we came home and wrapped our community wall around us and huddled in our illusions of security. Sunday, November 22, 2026. No one has found my father. Almost every adult in the neighborhood has spent some time looking. Richard Moss didn't, but his oldest son and daughter did. Wardell Parrish didn't, but his sister and oldest nephew did. I don't know what else people could have done. If I did know, I would be out doing it. And yet nothing, nothing, nothing. The police never came up with any sign of him. He never turned up anywhere. He's vanished. Gone. Even the severed arm's fingerprints weren't his. Every night since Wednesday, I've dreamed that horrible screaming. I've gone out twice more with teams hunting through the canyons. We've found nothing but more of the dead and the poorest of the living, people who are all staring eyes and visible bones. My own bones ached in empathy. Sometimes, if I sleep for a while without hearing the screaming, I see these, the living dead. I've always seen them. I've never seen them. A team I wasn't with found a living child being eaten by dogs. The team killed the dogs, then watched helpless as the boy died. I spoke at services this morning. Maybe it was my duty, I don't know. People came for church, all uncertain and upset, not knowing what they should do. I think they wanted to draw together, and they had years of habit drawing them together at our house on Sunday morning. They were uncertain and hesitant, but they came. Both Wyatt Talcott and Jay Garfield offered to speak. Both did say a few words. Both informally eulogizing my father, though neither admitted that that was what they were doing. I was afraid everyone would do that, and the service would become an impossible impromptu funeral. When I stood up, it wasn't just to say a couple of words. I meant to give them something they could take home, something that might make them feel that enough had been said for today. I thank them all for the ongoing, emphasize ongoing, efforts to find my father. Then I talked about perseverance. I preached a sermon about perseverance, if an unordained kid can be said to preach a sermon. No one was going to stop me. Corey was the only one who might have tried, but Corey was in a kind of walking coma. She wasn't doing anything she didn't have to do. So, I preached from Luke, chapter 18, verses 1 through 8, the parable of the importunate widow. It's one I've always liked. A widow is so persistent in her demands for justice that she overcomes the resistance of a judge who fears neither God nor man. She wears him down. Moral? The weak can overcome the strong if the weak persist. Persisting isn't always safe, but it's often necessary. My father and the adults present had created and maintained our community in spite of the scarcity and the violence outside. Now, with my father or without him, the community had to go on, hold together, survive. I talked about my nightmares and the source of those nightmares.
Some people might not have wanted their kids to hear things like that, but I didn't care. If Keith had known more, maybe he would still be alive. But I didn't mention Keith. People could say what happened to Keith was his own fault. No one could say that about Dad. I didn't want anyone to be able to say that about this community someday. Those nightmares of mine are our future if we fail one another, I said, winding up. Starvation, agony at the hands of people who aren't human anymore, dismemberment, death. We have God and we have each other. We have our island community, fragile and yet a fortress. Sometimes it seems too small and too weak to survive. And like the widow in Christ's parable, its enemies fear neither God nor man, but also like the widow, it persists. We persist. This is our place, no matter what. That was my message. I left it there, hanging before them with an unfinished feel to it. I could feel them expecting more, then realizing that I wasn't going to say more, then biting down on what I had said. At just the right moment, Kayla Talcott began an old song. Others took it up, singing slowly but with feeling. We shall not be moved. I think this might have sounded weak or even pitiful somehow if it had been sung by a lesser voice. I think I might have sang it weakly. I'm only a fair singer. Kayla, on the other hand, has a big voice, beautiful, clear, and able to do everything she asks of it. Also, Kayla has a reputation for not moving unless she wants to. Later, as she was leaving, I thanked her. She looked at me. I'd grown past her years ago, and she had to look up. Good job, she said, and nodded, and walked away toward her house. I love her. I got other compliments today, and I think they were sincere. Most said, in one way or another, you're right, and I didn't know you could preach like that, and your father would be proud of you. Yeah. I hope so. I did it for him. He built this bunch of houses into a community, and now he's probably dead. I wouldn't let them bury him. But I know. I'm no good at denial and self-deception. That was Dad's funeral that I was preaching, his and the community's. Because as much as I want all that I said to be true, it isn't. We'll be moved, all right. It's just a matter of when, by whom, and in how many pieces. Chapter 13. There is no end to what a living world will demand of you. Earthseed, the Books of the Living. Saturday, December 19th, 2026. Today, Reverend Matthew Robinson, in whose church I was baptized, came to preach my father's funeral. Corey made the arrangements. There was no body, no urn. No one knows what happened to my father. Neither we nor the police have been able to find out. We're sure he's dead. He would find a way to come home if he were alive, so we're certain he's dead. No, we're not certain. We're not certain at all. Is he sick somewhere, hurt, held against his will for who knows what reason by who knows what monsters? This is worse than when Keith died, so much worse. As horrible as that was, we knew he was dead. Whatever he suffered, we knew he wasn't suffering anymore. Not in this world, anyway. We knew. Now, we don't know anything. He is dead, but we don't know. The Dunns must have felt this when Tracy vanished. Crazy as they are, crazy as she was, they must have felt this. What do they feel now?
Tracy never came back. If she's not dead, what must have happened to her outside? A girl alone only faced one kind of future outside. I intend to go out posing as a man when I go. How will they all feel when I go? I'll be dead to them. To Corey, the boys, the neighborhood. They'll hope I'm dead, considering the supposed alternative. Thank Dad for my tallness and my strength. I won't have to leave Dad now. He's already left me. He was 57. What reason would strangers have for keeping a 57-year-old man alive? Once they'd robbed him, they would either let him go or kill him. If they let him go, he'd come home, walking, limping, crawling. So, he's dead. That's that. It has to be. Tuesday, December 22nd, 2026. The Garfields left for Olivar today. Phyllida, Jay, and Joanne. An armored KSF truck came from Olivar to collect them and their belongings. The adults of the community had all they could do to keep the little kids from climbing all over the truck and pestering the drivers to death. Most kids my brother's ages have never been close to a truck that runs. Some of the younger Moss kids have never seen a truck of any kind. The Moss kids weren't even allowed to visit the Yanni's house back when the Yanni's television still worked. The two guys from KSF were patient once they realized the kids weren't thieves or vandals. Those two guys with their uniforms, pistols, whips, and clubs looked more like cops than movers. No doubt, they had even more substantial weapons in the truck. My brother Bennett said he saw bigger guns mounted inside the truck when he climbed onto the hood. But when you consider how much a truck that size is worth and how many people might want to relieve them of it and its contents, I guess the weaponry isn't surprising. The two movers were a black and a white, and I could see that Corey considered that hopeful. Maybe Olivar wouldn't be the white enclave that Dad had expected. Corey cornered the black guy and talked to him for as long as he would let her. Will she try now to get us into Olivar? I think she will. After all, without Dad's salary, she'll have to do something. I don't think we have a prayer of being accepted. The insurance company isn't going to pay, or not for a long time. Its people chose not to believe that Dad is dead. Without proof, he can't be declared legally dead for 7 years. Can they hold on to our money for that long? I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me. We could starve many times over in 7 years. And Corey must know she alone can't earn enough in Olivar to feed and house us. Is she hoping to get work for me, too? I don't know what we're going to do. Joanne and I cried all over each other, saying goodbye. We promised to phone each other, to stay in touch. I don't think we'll be able to. It costs extra to call Olivar. We won't be able to afford it. I don't think she will either. Chances are, I'll never see her again. The people I've grown up with are falling out of my life, one by one. After the truck pulled away, I found Curtis and took him back to the old darkroom to make love. We hadn't done it for a long time, and I needed it. I wish I could imagine just marrying Curtis, staying here, and having a decent life with him. It isn't possible. Even if there were no Earth Seed, it wouldn't be possible. I would almost be doing the family a favor if I left now, one less mouth to feed. Unless I could somehow get a job. We've got to get out of here, too, Curtis said, as we lay together afterward, lingering, tempting fate, not wanting to lose the feel of each other so soon. But that wasn't what he had meant. I turned my head to look at him. Don't you want to go? He asked. Wouldn't you like to get out of this dead-end neighborhood, out of Robledo?
I nodded.
I was just thinking that, but I want you to marry me, and I want us to get out of here, he said in a near whisper. This place is dying.
I raised myself on my elbows and looked down at him. The only light in the room came from a single window up near the ceiling. Nothing covered it anymore, and the glass was broken out of it, but still, only a little light came in. Curtis's face was full of shadows.
Where do you want to go?
I asked him. Not Olivar, he said. That could turn out to be a bigger dead end than living here.
Where then?
I don't know. Oregon? Or Washington? Canada? Alaska? I don't think I gave any sign of sudden excitement. People tell me my face doesn't show them what I'm feeling. My sharing has been a hard teacher, but he saw something.
You've already been thinking about leaving, haven't you?
He demanded. That's why you won't talk about getting married. I rested my hand on his smooth chest. You were thinking about going alone. He grasped my wrist, seemed ready to push it away. Then he held on to it, kept it. You were just going to walk away from here and leave me. I turned so that he couldn't see my face, because now I had a feeling my emotions were all too obvious. Confusion, fear, hope. And of course I had intended to go alone. And of course I hadn't told anyone that I was leaving. And I had not decided yet how Dad's disappearance would affect my going. That raised frightening questions. What are my responsibilities? What will happen to my brothers if I leave them to Corey? They're her sons, and she'll move the earth to take care of them, keep them fed and clothed and housed, but can she do it alone? How?
I want to go, I admitted, moving around trying to be comfortable on the pallet of old sleep sacks that we had put down on the concrete floor. I planned to go. Don't tell anyone.
How can I if I go with you? I smiled, loving him, but
Corey and my brothers are going to need help, I said. When my father was here,
I plan to go next year when I'm 18. Now,
I don't know.
Where were you going?
North?
Maybe as far as Canada, maybe not.
Alone?
Yeah. Why?
Why alone, he meant.
I shrugged. I could get killed as soon as I leave here. I could starve. The cops could pick me up. Dogs could get me. I could catch a disease. Anything could happen to me. I've thought about it. I haven't named half the bad possibilities.
That's why you need help. That's why I couldn't ask anyone else to walk away from food and shelter and as much safety as there is in our world.
To just start walking north and hope you wind up someplace good? How could I ask that of you?
It's not that bad.
Farther north, we can get work.
Maybe.
But people have been flooding north for years. Jobs are scarce up there, too. And state lines and borders are closed. There's nothing down here.
I know.
So how can you help Corey and your brothers?
I don't know.
We haven't figured out what to do. So far, nothing I've thought of will work.
They'd have more of everything if you left.
Maybe. But Curtis, how can I leave them? Could you walk away and leave your family not knowing how they would manage to survive?
Sometimes I think so, he said.
I ignored that. He didn't get along very well with his brother Michael, but his family was probably the strongest unit in the neighborhood. Take on one of them, and you've got to deal with them all. He would never walk away from them if they were in trouble.
Marry me now, he said. We'll stay here and help your family get on its feet. Then we'll leave.
Not now, I said. I can't see how anything is going to work out now. Everything's too crazy.
And what? You think it's going to get sane?
It's never been sane.
You just have to go ahead and live, no matter what.
I didn't know what to say, so I kissed him. But I couldn't distract him.
I hate this room, he said. I hate hiding to be with you, and I hate playing games.
He paused. But I do love you.
Damn, sometimes I almost wish I didn't.
Don't wish that, I said. He knew so little about me, and he thought he knew everything. I'd never told him about my sharing, for instance. I'll have to, before I marry him. If I don't, when he finds out, he'll know I didn't trust him enough to be honest with him. And not much is known about sharing. Suppose I pass it on to my kids. Then there's Earthseed. I'll have to tell him about that. What will he think? That I've gone crazy? I can't tell him. Not yet.
We could live at your house, he said. My parents would help out with food. Maybe I could find some kind of job.
I want to marry you, I said. I hesitated, and there was absolute silence. I couldn't believe I'd heard myself say such a thing, but it was true. Maybe I was just feeling bereft. Keith, my father, the Garfields, Mrs. Quintanilla. People could disappear so easily. I wanted someone with me who cared about me and who wouldn't disappear. But my judgment wasn't entirely gone.
When my family is back on its feet, we'll marry, I said.
Then we can get out of here. I just have to know that my brothers will be all right.
If we're going to marry anyway, why not do it now?
Because I have things to tell you, I thought. Because if you reject me or make me reject you with your reactions, I don't want to have to hang around and watch you with someone else.
Not now, I said.
Wait for me. He shook his head in obvious disgust.
What the hell do you think I've been doing?
Thursday, December 24th, 2026. It's Christmas Eve. Last night, someone set fire to the Payne Parish house. When the community tried to put out the fire and then tried to keep it from spreading, three other houses were robbed. Ours was one of the three. Thieves took all our store-bought food, wheat flour, sugar, canned goods, packaged goods. They took our radio, our last one. The crazy thing is, before we went to bed, we had been listening to a half-hour news feature about increasing arson. People are setting more fires to cover crimes, although why they would bother these days, I don't know. The police are no threat to criminals. People are setting fires to do what our arsonists did last night, to get the neighbors of the arson victim to leave their own homes unguarded. People are setting fires to get rid of whomever they dislike, from personal enemies to anyone who looks or sounds foreign or racially different. People are setting fires because they're frustrated, angry, hopeless. They have no power to improve their lives, but they have the power to make others even more miserable. And the only way to prove to yourself that you have power is to use it. Then there's the fire drug, with its dozen or so names: Blaze, Fuego, Flash, Sunfire. The most popular name is Pyro, short for pyromania. It's all the same drug, and it's been around for a while. From what Keith said, it's becoming more popular. It makes watching the leaping, changing patterns of fire a better, more intense, longer-lasting high than sex. Like Paracetco, my biological mother's drug of choice, Pyro screws around with people's neurochemistry. But Paracetco began as a legitimate drug intended to help victims of Alzheimer's disease. Pyro was an accident. It was a homebrew, a basement drug, invented by someone who was trying to assemble one of the other higher-priced street drugs. The inventor made a very small chemical mistake and wound up with pyro. That happened on the East Coast and caused an immediate increase in the number of senseless arson fires, large and small. Pyro worked its way west without making nearly as much trouble as it could have. Now its popularity is growing. And in dry as straw Southern California, it can cause a real orgy of burning.
My God, Corey said when the radio report was over. And in a small, whispery voice, she quoted from the Book of Revelation. Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils.
And the devils set fire to the Payne Parish House. At about 2 a.m., I woke to the jangling of the bell. Emergency! Earthquake? Fire? Intruders? But there was no shaking, no unfamiliar noise, no smoke. Whatever was happening, it wasn't at our house. I got up, threw clothing on, debated for a second whether to snatch my survival pack, then left it. Our house didn't seem to be in immediate danger. My pack was safe in the closet, mixed in among blankets and bundles of old clothes. If I had to have it, I could come back and snatch it in seconds. I ran outside to see what was needed and saw at once. The Payne Parish House was fully involved, surrounded by fire. One of the watchers on duty was still sounding the alarm. People spilled from all the houses and must have seen, as I did, that the parish house was a total loss. Neighbors were already wetting down the houses on either side. A live oak tree, one of our huge, ancient ones, was afire. There was a light wind blowing, swirling bits of burning leaves and twigs into the air and scattering them. I joined the people who were beating and wetting the grounds. Where were the Paynes? Where was Wardell Parish? Had anyone called the fire department? A house full of people, after all. It wasn't like a burning garage. I asked several people. Kayla Talcott said she had called them. I was grateful and ashamed. I wouldn't have asked if Dad were still with us. One of us would have just called. Now we couldn't afford to call. No one had seen any of the Paynes. Wardell Parish I found in the Yannis yard, where Corey and my brother Bennett were wrapping him in a blanket. He was coughing so much that he couldn't talk, and wearing only pajama pants. "Is he okay?" I asked. "He's breathed a lot of smoke," Corey said. "Has someone called?" Kayla Talcott called the fire department. "Good. But no one's at the gate to let them in. I'll go." I turned away, but she caught my arm. "The others," she whispered. She meant the Paynes, of course. "I don't know." She nodded and let me go. I went to the gate, borrowing Alex Montoya's key on the way. He always seemed to have his gate key in his pocket. It was because of him that I didn't go back into our house and maybe interrupt a robbery and be killed for my trouble. Firefighters arrived in no great hurry. I let them in, locked the gate after them, and watched as they put out the fire. No one had seen the Paynes. We could only assume they had never gotten out. Corey tried to take Wardell Parish to our house, but he refused to leave until he found out one way or the other about his twin sister and his nieces and nephews. When the fire was almost out, the bell began to ring again. We all looked around. Caroline Balter, Harry's mother, was jerking and pushing the bell and screaming. "Intruders!" she shouted. "Thieves! They've broken into the houses!" And we all rushed without thinking back to our houses. Wardell Parish came along with my family, still coughing and wheezing, and as useless, as weaponless, as the rest of us. We could have been killed, rushing in that way. Instead, we were lucky. We scared away our thieves. Along with our store-bought food and the radio, the thieves got some of Dad's tools and supplies. Nails, wires, screws, bolts, that kind of thing. They didn't get the phone, the computer, or anything in Dad's office. In fact, they didn't get into Dad's office at all. I suppose we scared them away before they could search the whole house. They stole clothing and shoes from Corey's room, but didn't touch my room or the boys. They got some of our money, the kitchen money, Corey calls it. She had hidden it in the kitchen, in a box of detergent. She had thought no one would steal such a thing.